This will be our galaxy or our universe, so to speak, for this week. Why are you laughing? So with the different galaxies, so we have mutually unbiased bases, we have expander graphs, we have classical simulation of quantum systems, and we have measurement-based quantum computation, and we have quantum field theory even. And well, sort of this is a classification from a physicist's point of view. But we see that often in these areas, we encounter topics of graph theory. So let me give you a few examples. So we have graph width measures next to entanglement. We have local complementation next to local unitary equivalence. And we have knots, links, braids, and the Jones polynomial next to the partition function of the Ising model. So very often, mathematicians and quantum information people slash physicists are looking at the same objects, but often from different perspectives. And so maybe it would be a good time to exchange our views on this subject. Some of these connections are known. Some connections are known to some, but not to others. And I'm sure that there are connections out there that wait to be discovered. So let me briefly go through these five galaxies here. I will be very brief for the most part. So we have expander graphs, and we will hear about them in great detail from Aram Harrow later today and during the week also from Jens Eisert. So here you see an example. This is a graph where every vertex has degree 3, but the graph is otherwise random. And I mean, a very informal characterization of expander graphs would be that rumors spread exponentially fast in them. So suppose these vertices here would be people, and these edges would be telephone lines. And somebody sees walking, I don't know, Brad Pitt down Santa Monica Boulevard with somebody, I don't know, and a rumor starts. And if these telephone lines form an expander graph, an exponential number of people, exponential in the number of rounds of making phone calls, would know about it. And that is not true for every graph. If you would consider a lattice graph, you wouldn't have that property. So a rumor would only spread polynomially in a lattice graph. And expander graphs have many applications in the classical or in the theory of classical computing. They allow to minimize randomness and probabilistic algorithms, and they are also relevant for error correcting codes. And now the question arises, are they important for quantum information as well? And Aram's going to tell us about it. And then we have also presented today by Chris Godsill a talk on a set of equiangular lines and MOOPs and symmetrically information complete PLVMs. And well, they are relevant practically in quantum information for cryptography, for quantum cryptography. And they also appear in the context of the theory of quantum measurement. And they are interesting as well from the viewpoint of mathematics. So if you consider sets of equiangular lines in the vector space over the reals, this leads to nice combinatorial problems. But if you want to do that same thing in complex vector space, such a connection does not obviously exist. And what exists instead, we will learn today from Chris Godsill. OK, so here we will have a talk about graphs in quantum field theory as well. So how do graphs appear in quantum field theory if you have a perturbative expansion of your field theory, you have Feynman graphs. And these Feynman graphs encode the amplitude and therefore also the likeliness of certain scattering events of particles to occur. And sort of characteristic functions describing the content of a field theory in a perturbative expansion can be represented as a summation over various graphs. And there are two particular ones of them the energy functional as a functional of this external sources and the effective action. And they can be transformed into each other by the Legendre transformation. And that has been known for a very long time. But according to Achim Kempf, the existing proofs are leave something left to be desired, either in brevity or in exactness. And Achim Kempf is going to fix this for us in the final talk today. And then, I should say this in the beginning. So the talks today, they will be from different areas, and they show you roughly what this workshop spans. And we will follow up these topics during the course of the week. But today's talks, in a way, give you the span of the workshop. And we have something on structural measures of graph complexity, in particular graph width measures. And they are relevant for the classical simulation of quantum systems. So but if I remove my glasses, this graph here looks exactly like a tree to me, but it is only approximately a tree. And very loosely speaking, you can quantify how much it deviates from the tree by a measure called the tree width. And there are other similar such measures. For instance, the rank width, and both the tree width and the rank width will occur in the talks given at this workshop. And it turns out that for some NP-hard problems in graph theory, an efficient solution exists if the graphs on which these problems are considered have a bounded width. Okay, and this in fact has something to do with quantum mechanics. The simulation of spin systems can often be mapped to graphs. And well, if this graph turns out to have a small width, then efficient classical simulation method exists. And we'll hear about that from Yao Yunshi and Martin Fundenest. And we will have more on classical simulation of quantum systems from Joseph Geraci, from Hector Bombin, and Richard Yosa. I should say Richard Yosa's work will be on match gates, non-interacting fermions, and its relation to the Ising model. You could also associate graphs with his work, but in this case, the outstanding feature of the graphs would not be finite width or bounded width, it would rather be planarity of graphs. You agree?
And finally, let me talk
about measurement-based quantum computation, in particular the one-way quantum computer. And yeah, I decided to spend a few slides on that topic. I do not want to be imbalanced here in my introduction, but so see the remainder of this talk as part of this introductory program of this day. So there are two ways of evolution in quantum mechanics, two fundamental ways for quantum systems to evolve. There is the unitary evolution, and there is projective measurement, and they are fundamentally different. Now, if people think about quantum computation, you might think if these fundamental ways quantum systems can behave is also represented in quantum computation, and indeed it is. So most schemes of quantum computation use unitary evolution. So for example, the standard model of quantum computation, the circuit model, but also the adiabatic model, the quantum Turing machine, if you wish, and also if you regard quantum walks sort of as a computational model, they would be unitary as well. But you can also use measurements for quantum computation, and the one-way quantum computer is one of these schemes. And well, how would that work? You would have an entangled state of many particles, and you would measure every particle, every spin 1/2 particle in a certain direction, and that would constitute a computation. And we will have talks about that by a number of people, by Elham Kashefi, Dan Brown, Jens Eisel, Steve Flamia, Yayun Shi, and Akimasa Miyake. Okay, so since this is PI, I thought, why not talk a little bit about the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox? So that, well, I should say,
here we are essentially through with the introduction, but
I would like to say a little bit more about measurement-based quantum computation, and I believe that the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox gives me a nice way to do that. So in 1935, a paper came out asking the question of whether quantum mechanics would be a complete theory, would be sort of the final theory, final physical theory of the microscopic world. And so let us go briefly through the argument that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen gave. Their workhorse was a very familiar setting. They used what we would call an entangled state, and with one party make measurements on the respective particle, which would then project the particle on the other side. And let's see how they arrive at the conclusion that quantum mechanics is not a complete theory. I should make one remark here. The original Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument was not with a Bell state. It was rather with an entangled state of continuous variables. And I'm explaining it with a Bell state, and this alternation is mutable. Okay. So let's see. So what, well, they said we require two things of a physical theory. First, it should be correct. And second, it should be complete. I mean, they didn't doubt the correctness of quantum mechanics, but they said it would not be complete. So what is the requirement for completeness of a physical theory? Well, they say at least the following should be true, that every element of the physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory. So that clarifies the notion of completeness, but leads us to define what an element of reality is. And well, they say, okay, we don't really know, but let's at least come up with a sufficient criterion. That may be way too hard, and we may be missing some elements of reality, but at least that gives us some. So if, without in any way disturbing a quantum system, we can predict with certainty the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to that quantity. Okay, now let's see how they, with this machinery, with these notions introduced, they arrive at the conclusion that quantum mechanics is not a complete theory. First, they consider an individual spin 1/2 system. And they say, now we're going to measure non-commuting observables on that system. So let's prepare that system in an eigenstate of the spin observable sigma x, then of course measurement of that observable has a definite, yields a definite value for that observable. So to this operator, there corresponds an element of reality. The eigenvalue for sigma z measurement is not defined on that state, so we have no element of reality corresponding to that observable. And from this they say it follows that either quantum mechanical description of reality given by the wave function is not complete, or when the two operators corresponding to physical quantities do not commute, the two quantities cannot have simultaneous reality. And number two is what is the viewpoint that we usually take. This is what quantum mechanics suggests. So let's see how they construct the other alternative here. So they say, okay, assume alternative number two was wrong. Well, then we would need to be left with another alternative. So assuming this is wrong means we have two operators corresponding to physical quantities that do not commute, and nevertheless, the quantities are simultaneously real. If they are simultaneously real, then these predetermined measured eigenvalues must enter a complete description. Since the wave function does not contain both of these eigenvalues, the wave function cannot be complete. So if we negate alternative number two, we are led to alternative number one. Okay, so now we have two options. And with these two options at hand, they are considering an entangled state, Bell state. And they are now assuming that alternative number one was wrong and see what that leads to in this setting. So assuming alternative number one is wrong means the wave function is a complete description. Now, they let party A measure the observable sigma x on her particle. And that, of course, projects the second particle and therefore makes sigma x on particle B an element of reality. And now in the similar lines, particle A measures the observable sigma x. And in this way, particle B is projected in the eigenstate of sigma z, making sigma z of particle B an element of reality. But both these scenarios, EPR argue, are derived from the same complete wave function. So they belong to the same physical reality. So we arrive at the situation that two observables, although they are non-commuting, they are simultaneously elements of reality. And that would mean sort of alternative number two is wrong. So negating alternative number one also leads to negation of alternative number two. So we are left with no alternatives. And so they argue, well, that must mean that alternative number one is correct, meaning that according to their definition of reality, quantum mechanics is not a complete theory. But the paper doesn't end there. There are two more paragraphs, and I have copied here for you the second last paragraph of the paper. And they stop and say, oh, maybe our criterion for reality wasn't quite right. And then they ponder that thought a little while and say, no, our criterion for reality was exactly right. By the way, I'm not, in particular, in the presence of Chris Fuchs, okay, so do you recognize this paragraph here?
Okay.
He didn't write it, he said.
Okay, anyway. So maybe you just go through this passage for the moment. So EPR say, no, our criterion for reality was exactly right, but maybe you read that in your own words. Okay, I would guess. I would guess the alternative that they were not prepared to take in 1935. It looks much more attractive today after a number of alternatives. Routes have been pursued. Okay, well, this is what I want to say about the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, and it gave me
a nice start now to continue with measurement-based quantum computation, in particular the one-way model. And so we will be essentially considering a very similar scenario, but we will slightly generalize it, slightly modify it, and then be asking different kinds of questions. We will not be concerned with quantum mechanics. We accept it pretty much as a theory. What we will be asking, rather, is questions about the theory of quantum computation. So what are the elementary building blocks of quantum computation? And how are they composed? And questions like that. So, as I said, we just take the EPR scenario and generalize it a little bit. So instead of one party A and one party B, or Alice and Bob, we have now many Alices and many Bobs. Well, that also requires to generalize the Bell state that we previously used. And one generalization that makes sense here is to consider a so-called cluster state. And it's a generalization in the sense that if you restrict it to two particles, you get the Bell state back. Okay, and the point here is that now, in a similar setting where every party, the Alices and the Bobs, measure their spins individually, you can perform universal quantum computation. So the Alices, by their measurements, they can set up a quantum algorithm, and then the Bobs, by their measurements, can read out the computational result. And here is where we're deviating from the EPR setting. So in principle, it is still the same as with EPR. Once the Alices have performed their measurements and communicated their measurement outcomes, what the Bobs will measure is completely determined. So it can be predicted. However, to actually do this prediction would now be a complicated computation. And furthermore, to learn these readout bits, the outcomes of these measurements, suddenly becomes desirable because these bits represent the outcome of a quantum computation. So the Bobs, because they are a little bit lazy, say, oh, we're not going to predict what we measure right away. Okay, and that's, in short, is the one-way quantum computing. So let me reiterate what I think was the main point on the last slide, namely that every quantum computation can be performed in this way, namely by measuring individual spin variables on a cluster state. So the cluster state is a universal resource. So why is this resource viewpoint any useful? Why should we regard the cluster state as a resource? So the first point is it is rather special. Only a few resource states are known that have this property to allow universal quantum computation by local measurements. And also, it is consumable. So after you have done your computation, you have used up the state. You are left with a product state. And the product state is good for nothing. So you cannot repeat this process with the product state. And this being so, we can now ask the question, well, there are still a number of states that can be used for universal computation. So what is the essential quantum mechanical property in them that allows that? And if we have identified such an essential property, can it be quantified? Well, first, whatever this essence is, it must not increase under local operational and classical communication. And it must be zero for product states. So this is exactly what we require of entanglement monotones. So if you think this essential property here is entanglement, you can make a rather strong case for that. And I believe this case will be made during this workshop. Anyway, there's another thing that I'd like to mention. So my subdivision in Alices and Bobs was somewhat artificial. It's all in the correlations that is important here. So Bob, with his measurements, would learn nothing. He needs to take into account the measurement outcomes that he received from the Alices in order to interpret his results. So all the measurement outcomes here are important. And we can see this back in the original EPR setting. So, well, the Alice and the Bob there can decide both to measure in sigma x or both in sigma z. In either case, each measurement outcome will be completely undefined. What is real are only the correlations. So if they measure both in z, say, the spins will be correlated. If they measure both in x, they will be anti-correlated. And these correlations are real. The measurement outcomes themselves are random. Okay, so what are the open questions here in this scenario? Well, the most important question, to which I think it is fair to say we have no answer, is can we construct novel algorithms in the one-way quantum computer model directly? Does it give us new intuition for quantum algorithms? And then there are two other important questions, I think, about which we know for a bit at least, and they are, what are the logical building blocks in this computational model and what's their composition principle, and where does the quantum speedup come from? Okay, and I hope we're going to discuss about these questions here in this workshop. But answers to these questions are not easily to come by. So what do? Well, you walk around. You see if you hit interesting structure. And if you start here and go this way, well, you slightly generalize cluster states, get graph states. And it doesn't take you long to arrive at local complementation. And we are going to hear tomorrow about local complementation from a mathematician, because it turns out it has long been studied in graph theory. If you go that direction, you pretty quickly end up with the easing model. And from the easing model, it's not far into topology. So you go to the Jones polynomial, you go to knots, links, and braids. And we are happy that we have a few talks here in this area. I should say, once you are here, these talks will have little obvious a connection with this topic over here. Yeah, so they will not be addressing measurement-based quantum computation directly, but well, I think there's still a remote link, and I'm very much looking forward to this. And well, that brings me back to my introductory slide with all the five topics presented. And as I said, we'll be hearing about all of them today. And I hope that during the workshop, we identify many connections and discuss them. So enjoy the workshop.
So the first speaker of the day will be Krishna Krishnakumar, and he will be talking